afternoon, Chicago. Welcome in. We are live and we are local. I am Alex Kuhn. I am with Adam Studzinski, my co-host today, and Grant Leader on the other side of the glass. Welcome in after a Cubs 10-2 victory over the Kansas City Royals as they take 2 of 3 over the weekend. Studs, we're going to get into a lot of Bears talk today.
Yes,
a Cubs team right now with a lot of confidence, and they should have a lot of confidence because they've clearly been energized by what the front office did at the trade deadline, and they seem like they're ready to make a stretch run in the middle of a pennant race.
This is what the third different Cubs team this season to me, because they started the year and you thought they were good, and then they had that horrible stretch where they lost 10 games in a row and lost a bunch in the standings, and they were back at 500. They've been good ever since then, and the post-trade deadline team, though, has me feeling like this Cubs team has some juice to it now.
Yep.
They've got some real juice, and that horrible stretch was earlier in the year, and injuries played a part of it and all that, but this team really has some juice now. This team is fun to watch. They're fun to listen to, and man, they don't have a lot of bad spots on their team right now. They really don't.
They really don't. They don't have a lot of holes, and they seem like they're ready to make a run at a championship if they can get through the National League. So I think my question for you, if you're listening out there, 312-644-6767, is this team's energized. How energized are you, Cubs fans? Because this has been a very difficult season for the psyche of the Cubs fan base. Like you said, the 10-game winning streaks early in the season, then the 10-game losing streaks, the injuries to the pitching staff, the up-and-down bullpen. They addressed a lot of those needs at the deadline. They have clearly responded to what they did at the deadline, and they're very confident in what they can do down the stretch of the season. But Cubs talk will not be all that we get to today. The Bears, they are a walking mash unit right now. A bunch of injuries, including a couple other players leaving practice today at Halas Hall that was supposed to be open to the public. Then rain came through the area.
Real quick, does anyone on the south side or up at Lake Forest have a weather radar that they can access? I felt like a couple of the things
that
happened around here were avoidable today, but we don't get to get into that.
Give a little lead time on canceling practice?
Maybe
start the game in the delay today.
Yeah, but just saying. That's
a different conversation for a different day. But we're going to have Dan Weider of The Athletic joining us here in about 15 minutes as he was at practice today. I know, Studs, you work with him on the Take the North podcast.
TTN with
Mark Grody. He's going to join us in at the top of the hour at 5 o'clock. Something that Pete Crow Armstrong said on a podcast recently really, I think, got people's antennas up. A couple things that he said. First, one about Babe Ruth, and then another about how he approaches the game and his psyche.
When it comes to
playing the game, that I thought really connected a lot of the dots and explained a lot of what we are seeing from him since May 30th, by the way. And I like that everybody is using that date as a line of demarcation, because that was the day that PCA hit the ball, hit a home run into the Tarps Off crew in St. Louis after they chanted overrated. And then we're going to get into some more Bears talk at 6 o'clock. And who should be the Bears' next Hall of Famer? Inductees into the Hall of Fame, Hall of Fame weekend taking place in Canton this weekend. Who should be the next Bear inducted into the Hall of Fame? So plenty to get to today, Studs.
37 Hall of Famers for the Bears already. So who's going to be the next one? But yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun today. Good to be here with you, man.
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is going to be fun. It's going to be fun. We've got what a little over 2 hours here.
Yep, we're going to 7.
So yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be great. We got a lot of Bears thoughts, but I know the Cubs thing is a hell of a lot of fun right now. And I don't want to be the Debbie Downer here. But the first thing that happened after the Cubs won today was the Brewers also won in 10 innings over the Twins. So the Cubs have this great last week. They won 5 games in a row. They have won a series now in Kansas City, taking 2 out of 3, a series you expected them to win. The Royals aren't good. But the Brewers took care of their own business, and so after all that, the Cubs lost half a game in the standings this weekend. And I'm not trying to be the Debbie Downer. I know we're talking about how fun this team is, but it's just so frustrating. It's got to be when you're winning all the time now, but every time you lose, damn it, the Brewers win, so you lose a game.
5.5 games up in the NL Central standings are the Milwaukee Brewers. The Cubs, 69-51. On the season. 312-644-6767. Let's get out to the phone lines. Marcus, you are on the Score.
Hey, man, you guys just brought it up. I know the Cubs are exciting. I'm actually a Sox fan. But I just wanted to ask you guys, how can they beat the Brewers, man? The Brewers got their number, man, since the last couple of years, right? How can they do it, guys?
That is a great question, Marcus. And I do feel, maybe not to catch the Brewers, because I'm not, at this point, don't know if they can make up 5.5 games in the standings. But think about going into a playoff series against them. Say the Cubs are able to get out of the wild card round. They get into a playoff series with the Brewers. It feels like they are much more equipped to possibly win that series than they were last year. And remember, they were one game away from doing it last year.
They were.
Because of the pitching that they added at the trade deadline, as opposed to last year when they didn't arm themselves with weaponry in the starting rotation or coming out of the bullpen.
They ran out of pitching last year.
They did.
Is what happened. They didn't have anyone that could start the last game of the season. Well, they had Shota Imanaga available, and they didn't trust him to make the start, right? This year, they have several guys. And in fact, we were talking before the show about how things could play out rotation-wise if you go into the playoffs. But to the Brewers' point real quick, the best chance the Cubs have, to answer the caller's question, they have 7 games left against the Brewers. They have a 4-game series, a 3-game series between August, and those games are all they are in Chicago for the 4-game series, August 31st to September 3rd. Then they go they have another series in between, and then they go back up to Milwaukee. So they play them 2 out of 3 series, basically. That's your chance to catch them, because then you can directly impact making up one whole game at a time, right? We know right? So. That's their best chance right there. Because otherwise, I don't know if the Brewers... I like this Cubs team right now better than I like the Brewers team. I would take them in a series over the Brewers. But the problem is the Brewers are beating everyone else. And so it's impossible to make a distance on them unless you're playing them. So
7 more games, like you said.
Yeah, so that's their best chance to catch the Brewers.
So let's look at the pitching from this past weekend. Something that you pointed out, Studs, is 17 games in 17 days for the Cubs. They go 12-5 over that stretch. And they only have to use 5 pitchers this weekend going into their first off day.
In the last 2 games, they used 5 pitchers.
In their last 2 games, they've used 5 pitchers. They go in the off day, they're going to get a nice boost of energy for their pitching staff going into their series this week. So let's look at Matthew Boyd today. 7 innings pitched, 5 hits, 2 earned runs, all came on the hanging breaking ball that he threw to Starling Marte in the 4th inning. So an outstanding job by Matthew Boyd today. Kevin Gausman on Friday night.
Great.
He found his splitter, and that was going to be the X factor for Gausman. We know what type of playoff pedigree that he has, and he was brought in to be your number 1 or 2 starter in the playoffs. And I know Matt Spiegel on Hit and Run earlier today pointed out that he thinks he would be the number 1 starter going into a playoff series, but he threw it 53%. Of the time on Friday night. He threw it effectively. His spin rate was up for both his four-seamer and his fastball. His velocity was up a little bit. He goes 7 innings, and you couldn't have asked for a better start for him. And I know there was a scary moment when he took a line drive off the lower half of his body.
And the same thing happened to Clay Holmes yesterday.
Yep.
That's just... I don't know what's going through your head when that happens. This is something else you're talking about before the show. You're coming off, for Gausman, not coming off an injury. Clay Holmes is coming
Clay
off an injury.
Holmes, yes.
But Gausman, new team, first start with the new team. Hey, wake up, kid. Here we go. Without a kid. But wake up. You're on a new team. Pitch. Get going.
So he had surgery on his leg prior to the season. Then he gets hit by a 111-mile-an-hour line drive.
On his leg.
On his leg on May 15th. He misses the next 3 months. Last night...
This is Clay Holmes, right?
This is Clay Holmes. Last night is Clay Holmes' first start since May 15th. And the first pitch that he throws is Carter Jensen hitting it 98 miles an hour right at his shin.
Yeah, again.
Yeah, yeah. Wake up.
Wake up.
Wake up. Yeah. Like you don't have time to get yourself comfortable and back in the mix of things. You immediately get a line drive hit right at the the leg that you've had surgery on and you've had to miss 3 months because of.
And Holmes wasn't nearly as effective as Gausman was yesterday.
No.
Holmes went 4 innings, 6 hits, 4 runs, all of them are a couple walks, just once. The Cubs only had 1 strikeout as a team yesterday, which is wild. Like, how often do you see that in modern baseball? But anyway, so Clay Holmes, but I'm not panicking about Clay Holmes yet. I was working the game yesterday, and Coomer said multiple times during the broadcast that it looks like he's a little rusty.
Of course he would be.
You got time to figure out what Clay Holmes is or isn't. Is he going to be a guy that's starting? Is he going to be a guy you want coming out of the bullpen? You got plenty of time to figure that out, and you have a pretty healthy lead in the number one wild card spot. You're not desperate for what his role is right now. You got plenty of time to figure that out. Matthew Boyd has been excellent. And I want to ask, whether it's you or the callers out there, because Matt Spiegel said this morning, like you said, Alex, he's starting Gausman first game in a playoff series. I don't know how you look past Matthew Boyd right now. I really don't. Matthew Boyd has been so lights out. Listen, the games before today where he went 7 innings again, August 3rd, 6.2 innings, gave up 4 runs, but still got you 6.2 innings. That was his worst outing that he'd had in a month. The start before that, 7 innings, no runs. Start before that, 7 innings, 1 run. Start before that, 6 innings, 1 run. And then the start before that was the last time he gave up more than 1 run, 6.1 innings, 4 runs. That was back on July 12th. I don't know how you're passing that up. This will play itself out. Yeah. I think you'll know by the end of the regular season who's your number one guy. But I don't. This is a good problem to have, though. If you're Craig Counsell and you're sitting there saying, "Man, I don't know Matthew Boyd or Gausman," I don't know. That's a good problem to have.
This is a really good problem to have.
It's credit to Jed Hoyer for going out and making the move.
This is why what they did at the trade deadline it makes every bit of difference, right? And if you want to follow Marcus on the phone line, 312-644-6767, Alex Kuhn, Adam Studzinski, live and local with you until 7 o'clock.
Hello.
We have Dan Weider of The Athletic and Take the North TTN joining us here in about a little less than 10 minutes, as it was an interesting day at Bears practice. Xavion Thomas leaving with an injury. We got a little bit of an update on Luther Burden, so we'll hear from Dan, as I mentioned, here in less than 10 minutes. But the way that things line up for the Cubs in the with the starting rotation and in the bullpen, there are going to be some tough decisions that Craig Counsell is going to have to make in a good way. Because all year long, Craig Counsell has not gotten nearly enough credit for the job that he has done this season.
It's been masterful.
Yes.
It's been masterful what he's been doing.
No,
yes.
he's been outstanding. And I think at this point, he deserves much more recognition in the NL Manager of the Year race, but that's a different story for a different day. But he told Jed, you have until the All-Star break. I can get you to the All-Star break with what we have, no Cade Horton, with injuries Boyd.
Palencia is out.
We're throwing Hobie Milner and Caleb Thielbar out into high leverage situations.
Even Savali.
Savali got
a save. This is a couple weeks ago now. And early last week when the save Savali got in extra innings. And I'm sitting here, Ray Diaz is working the game, and I'm sitting in the back of the room just waiting for the game to play out. They send Savali out for the save in the bottom of the inning, and I'm like, oh, this isn't good.
Nope.
And it just made me feel like, especially because this is before the trade deadline.
Yeah.
And it made me think that Craig, at that point, was just like sending guys out there because he has to. He's got no one else. He's like, I got no one else. Savali. And then he's looking up at the box at Jed Hoyer. Like, hey, you see this? You see what I'm doing here?
We're in a rough spot.
Grant, wasn't it the first time this happened this season, we saw it was the series in Milwaukee, the series finale where they had to throw Jordan Wicks out there with runners at second and third and the tying run and go-ahead run in scoring position.
You got to be concerned if you're throwing Jordan Wicks in a high-liver spot right there.
He puts them into the game. Somehow they wiggle themselves out of a crazy jam, and he's just going nuts in the clubhouse. And that was the point where we're like, oh, yeah, there it is. Craig is showing some emotion in the dugout, which he does, by the way. I never quite understood the whole he should yell and scream and be demonstrative in the clubhouse. He does it in his own way, but since after that it almost felt like he was in mode.
Yeah, he's just throwing guys out there and be like, hey, this is the best I can do. Jed, you see that? And Jed got him some help. Jed got the message loud and clear.
There was a moment where he's like, oh yeah, do you have to, he was asked about having to have good defense behind some of the pitchers that they have because they don't have a lot of velocity. He's like, well, if you have Josh Hader, like I had in Milwaukee, you don't really need that great of a defense. That was a not-so-subtle indication. Like, please get me some velocity, get me some more horses.
He said that just the other day, too. I believe it was yesterday before the game. He was asked, you know, about guys like Clay Holmes coming in, guys that are single secret ball pitchers coming in. Is like, hey, yeah, defense would probably help them. He's like, well, yeah, good defense is going to help pretty much every pitcher unless you're blowing them away, like you mentioned Josh Hader.
Since last time I was up here, obviously Kobe went down with the injury. We're still in an information collection phase on that in terms of the timeline and the extent of it. We should have more information here within the next few days, though.
Coach, you said that you're still in the information gathering phase with Kobe and his injury. Does that mean that the reported 8 to 10 week timeline is not confirmed yet?
I don't know where you guys got that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, hasn't been said here. So I'll let you guys know whenever we know for sure what it looks like for him.
That was Ben Johnson, Bears head coach, taking a not-so-subtle shot at Adam Schefter earlier in the week. Alex Kuhn alongside Adam Studzinski. We've got Grant Leader on the other side of the glass. We're talking some Cubs in the last hour. And now, Studs, it's time to talk some Bears because I have two-thirds of the Take the North podcast here.
You're damn right you do, Alex. Dan Wiederer covers the Bears for The Athletic, senior writer for The Athletic, Bears reporter there. Also co-host of the Take the North podcast, along with Mark Grody, a podcast that I produce, regular contributor right here on The Score. Dan, what's up, man?
Hey, guys. How are you?
Doing good. Okay, Dan, let's just get all the injury stuff out of the way first. Okay.
So who was practicing today, Dan?
Is it easier to tell us who was practicing at this point?
Certainly on defense and in the secondary, that's the case. And there's just a long list of guys that are missing right now. I'll start in the secondary just because I think there's a half dozen key names out right now. It's Kyler Gordon. It's Kobe Bryant. It's Elijah Hicks. It's Cam Lewis. It's Terrell Smith. It's Jalen Jones. You go right down the list and you understand how thin they are right now at both safety and the nickel position and how much troubleshooting they're having to do here even before they get to the first preseason game. The other notable names missing today include Luther Burden, Braxton Jones, Montez Sweat. We can keep going, fellas. You tell me where you want to stop.
Okay, let's do the newest one. It was reported that Xavier Thomas left practice today. What do you know about that?
Nothing at this point, and we'll get a sense of what's happening here in the coming days. The Bears are going to be back in action on Tuesday for what is a late afternoon practice and is expected to be pretty intense. I think it's a scrimmage format where there'll probably be a lot of live periods, but I was expecting maybe for it to be a little bit lighter today, and it was pretty heavy in terms of the workload and some of the intensity of it today. This is Camp Ben right now, and so a lot of things going on. You hope you find your way to the regular season with enough health to go be competitive in Carolina, but certainly you're just having to go through some of the waves right now that happened during the preseason.
Dan Wiederer of The Athletic and the Take the North podcast joining us now as we're live in local. Alex Kuhn alongside Adam Studzinski on The Score. Dan, I've heard a lot of people wondering, is there more physicality to this camp? Is it overly physical, or is this just part of sometimes what happens this time of year where you get unlucky with the injury bug?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter, and you have to take each injury kind of in a case-by-case basis, and so there's been a bunch of these that have come up during one-on-one settings, and those are going to be done. You know, it's not like this is just all like live tackling periods where guys are getting rolled up on, and it's like, man, we should probably slow that down. Some of this is just in the competitive setting of drills that go on at every camp across the NFL, and so it is what it is, but there is an intensity to Ben's practices that he feels is necessary to get this team ready to be a championship-level football team. Obviously, there's a lot of trust in the methodology. There's a lot of trust in the vision of the head coach. And, you know, you just hope along the way you get the health back to a place where it feels a little bit more comfortable when you go out to practice and you see who's available to you.
So, all right, just a couple more injury things then. First of all, just as an aside, I'm all for them having physical practices, and the injury stuff is just bad luck to me. But Luther Burden was the most notable person that left practice. Not that Xavien Thomas isn't notable, but that's not expected to contribute as much this year as all. Luther Burden, it was reported by Ian Rappaport today, Dan, that he has a groin issue and will be out at least a little while or something to that effect.
A little bit of time.
A little bit of time. There it is. Thank you.
The wording.
So, were you able to learn anything more up there today, or is that just what we know at this point?
That's what we know at this point. The head coach was not available today. It was Dennis Allen speaking before the practice. And, you know, I think we'll get a little bit more information as we go forward. Did see the injury to Luther Burden. That happened again in a one-on-one setting on Saturday in a rep against Tyreek Stevenson. And they both were competing for the football. And Tyreek went down and appeared to be in more pain. It looked like he maybe landed on his right hip or his tailbone or somewhere in that right glute region there where he was in a lot of discomfort. And then we watched Luther kind of limp off, and we're like, oh, God, that rep just took two of these guys out. Tyreek, to his credit, came back and finished the practice on Saturday and actually came back today and had a pretty strong practice, including an interception to Caleb Williams. Luther was a casualty of that rep. And so now, obviously, you know, when you are a front office and a coaching staff at this stage with the guys that you know are going to be really important to you, you have to be very careful with some of the soft tissue stuff to slow play it in a way where, again, when you get these guys back, they stay back. And the goal, the target goal, obviously, is to have them ready to go out of the starting gates in Charlotte when week one arrives.
Yeah. I was going to ask, how precautionary does this all feel when you see some of these guys leaving practice early and not returning?
Yeah, again, it's kind of case by case. I mean, right. You know, I think, again, like Tyreek came and finished practice the other day, and so it was obviously something that they weren't worried about. It's just, it really is individual by individual and what happens to their specific injury. So it's hard to say. But again, like, I think you do have a group here that understands the big picture and trying to set the target for what really matters, which is having your full strength football team ready to go when you get to the regular season.
Dan, do you think we're going to see Caleb Williams or any starters on Saturday night or Saturday afternoon at Soldier Field against the Browns?
Some starters, I would think, will have to play a little bit. I don't know. This is going to be really interesting because they have the two crossover practices the following 2 weeks against Cincinnati and Tennessee, which you would assume if you go hard with your starters on Thursday, you're probably not going to ask them to do much on Saturday. So I wouldn't be surprised if this was the window where they tried to get the starters, some starters, a little bit more work. Don't know what the plan is for Caleb at this point. I think obviously the volume that they're trying to get him through training camp, through these crossover practices, is something that they're going to be very, very intentional with, to the point where, you know, you want him to get out on the field during the preseason a little bit, just to go through the reps, whether that's pregame, whether that's taking a series or two or three in one of these games. We'll see how Ben decides to do it. But certainly I think they have that plan, even if they haven't vocalized it yet.
Okay. I got a couple Caleb questions, Dan.
Here for it.
All right. Because let's see if we can get into some more of the fun stuff here. So how has Caleb, and when I asked this generically, so, but what has been different about Caleb in this camp? Not just compared to last year, but just when you see him out there, what's different this year?
I think comfort, honestly. I think it's the first word that popped to mind when you started that question. And there was a 7-on-7 period today where there was not a wow throw in there. but there just seemed to be a rhythm. And look, it's 7-on-7. You're not facing the pass rush of Caleb going through his progressions, and it was 1-2-3, and if one wasn't there, he was on to two. And it just, like, it felt like the rhythm you want to have out of your starting quarterback, you know. And so that's encouraging in flashes to see those types of moments come through the pipeline. And I just think overall it's so boring to talk about, but the operation pre-snap last year was so sloppy. And there was just so much coming at Caleb that you just couldn't get as much done in a practice because you were just trying to figure out how to spit out play calls in the huddle and get to the line of scrimmage and get the snap off cleanly. Now you're just into that next level where that stuff's not an issue. And so the comfort level of getting to the line and now being able to go to that next level, okay, let's run this play and let's see what the defense is giving us and how do I react to that with my decision-making and with where my eyes go and with where my body goes. That's all, it's just better, you know, and so you see this sort of upward arrow for Caleb in that regard. And obviously there's going to be wild throws every day. The one today in a full team period to beat a blitz, he just let one fly to Jahdae Walker, who got free with the defense coming with heavy pressure. And it was just a beautiful ball that, you know, made the whole offensive side of the ball roar. You know, we were inside today because of the surprise storm that rolled up through around noon. And it was just, it was an audible moment, right? Like where you watch it with your eyes and then you hear the reaction and you're like, yeah, that's Caleb right there.
Dan Weider, senior writer and Bears reporter from The Athletic, joining us now. Alex Kuhn alongside Adam Studzinski. And Dan, something that Press Taylor said earlier in the week kind of it caught my ears, because he was asked whether or not about the efficiency of the run game. And he said, we don't care about efficiency. We want explosiveness. Like, are we, as Bears consumers and Bears fans out there, and those of us those of you who cover in the Bears in the media, is it hard for us to kind of wrap our mind around an offensive staff that just feels like nobody should be able to stop us? I don't care about any stinking efficiency or controlling the clock or any of that crap. We want to score 50 points.
Yeah, it's so wild, because we're just not used to living in this world where you can say those things out loud and mean them, right? Like, that's what this is. And it's so fascinating, because the Bears had the NFC's best running game last year, and yet they came into the offseason feeling like, man, we left a lot on the table and we can get better there. I think they made a jump. You guys would have to double check this, but it was something like in total scoring from the previous year before Ben, they were like 28th in the league in points, and they made a jump to like 7th or somewhere there last year. Massive jump. And you're like, they barely scratched the surface of who they want to be offensively and yet still made all this market progress. It's incredible to kind of watch this thing come to life and understand that they're nowhere near the finish line of who they want to be. And so it's amazing. The running game in particular, you talk to people around the league and they have great admiration for the way Ben designs it, the spatial awareness he has, his ability to understand angles, to put defenses in conflict, and then you just marry that up with this killer mentality of, like, we're not just trying to get 5 yards on this play, we're trying to get an explosive run and hopefully something that demoralizes you for the next hour. You know what I mean? And that's the mentality that this coaching staff works from, with Ben as the leader of that. And it's going to be just really fun to watch the next step of this offensive evolution, both with the running game and the entirety of the offense this next year, because they have playmakers, they have a quarterback, they have a play caller. And so you just let your imagination run wild for the things that are possible if they can get this thing going early.
So since we're on the running game here, something that Darnell Wright said this past week after he spoke to you guys up there following the announcement of his contract extension, you know, talking about how Ben really made him and some of the other guys feel involved in the play. Like, he would say, like, hey, basically say, Darnell Wright, this play is you. Like, this running play, this is on you. This is on you to make this play for us. And I'm sure it's some of those pin and pulls that they did that resulted in huge yardage. So what was your reaction to the way Darnell Wright talked about how the way that they are used in the running game and making them feel involved, like they're really important to a play?
Well, there's two parts to this. I will start with the Ben part of this, where he is just so smooth at connecting with players and letting them understand the purpose of everything they do. And everything he says resonates with these guys. And I just can't stress enough how often a player has come to talk to us over the last 2.5 weeks and just expressed that confidence and trust in what the coach lays out for them. And so what you're talking about there is taking a top 10 talent in Darnell Wright and then understanding that this guy can be a playmaker in my offense, right? Like, he's got special gifts, and so we're going to do things to feature him, right? Like, this play isn't necessarily going to feature Kyle Manungai or DeAndre Swift. It's going to feature Darnell Wright, and those other two guys will have the ball in their hand, or one of those two guys, obviously, will have the ball in their hand. And so that's kind of the next-level thinking of Ben. But then it comes down to how the player receives it. And when you're hearing Darnell Wright say, man, like, he gave me a heightened sense of purpose. He gave me an understanding of why me doing my job is so important to why this play is going to work. And then it all starts to hum. And you, again, like, that's going to be different for Darnell than it will be for a guy that maybe not as talented. You're not going to feature someone else that doesn't have the brute strength and some of that mobility that Darnell has. But it applies to everybody across the roster, where you try to bring out their best gifts and understand why their best gifts are important. All of that marries together, and I think that sort of exchange we had with Darnell earlier in the week was just another one of these moments where you're like, man, like, Ben is not only this offensive visionary, but his emotional intelligence allows him to reach these players in a way that really brings a lot of cool things to life.
So you're saying that we're not going to be seeing plays that feature Karan Amagaji if he's not? Okay, got it.
Yeah, right. Maybe it's a combination of Karan Amagaji. He's on the same side with Joe Tooney, and you say, hey, fellas, like, you know, we need to go this way with this play, and here's what you've got to understand needs to happen from your end for this thing to click. And then, yeah, and then hopefully it all clicks regularly, because I think we're all sort of imagining just how much this offense can be effective if they get everybody in unison.
Almost 70% of the Bears' rush yardage last year was middle or to the right. You saw both Bears running backs averaging 7 yards per carry to the outside right. And you had Ben Johnson earlier this week saying, I don't really think that moving Darnell Wright over to the left side is in the cards at this point. But speaking of left tackle, Braxton Jones missing some time, Jedrick Wills having his struggles a little bit, Karan Amagaji getting some run at with the first team. What's going on with the blind side protector?
Right. I mean, you just laid it out there that it's this like three-man competition that we walked into camp with, and the front runner is now injured, and the second guy seems like he's just kind of had an ordinary camp in Jedrick Wills. And so now Karan Amagaji is finding himself a window of opportunity to try and go seize something here. I don't know how long Braxton will be out. It doesn't sound like it'll be a lengthy issue, but he's had durability issues here over the last few years. And so you have to start kind of solidifying contingency plans and depth and all those things. And so this is a moment in time for Karan Amagaji to try to take the next step forward in who he is as a player. And again, you're staring down the barrel of taking that flight to North Carolina in September with him potentially lining up to be your starting left tackle in the season opener. And so you've got to work with that in mind and understand, okay, this is a go time for Karan, for the coaching staff, for the entire offense to kind of try to figure out what this is going to look like no matter who's in there.
Dan, on the defensive side of the football, there's a lot of talk about fundamentals. I know Jervon Dexter, after practice today, said that he needs to improve his stance. He's didn't have the right stance last year. There's a lot of talk about attacking the line of scrimmage and the rotation of guys between Grady Jarrett and Jervon Dexter, James Street, Neville Gallimore, Kentavious Street, James Lynch, and Jordan Vandenberg. What do you make of the defensive line, what you've seen there, and also of this sort of feisty Dennis Allen that you guys are getting during training camp?
Well, to the second question, I've enjoyed DA in the several times that we've talked to him since camp began. He's had some energy, some feist to him, but he's had some answers to him too, which is good. They're like, that's all I ask. You can bring any sort of temperament or attitude you want up to that dais, but as long as you listen to the questions that are being asked and try to provide a solid answer to them, I'm all for it. You know, and so there's been some good exchanges here over the last couple weeks there. This defensive tackle room, Alex, to me is really fascinating because it's this blend of veterans who've been around the block, Neville Gallimore, Grady Jarrett, is these rookies that are really enthusiastic to carve out a role, guys like Jordan Vandenberg and Jaden Loving. You've got this mix of Jervon Dexter and Kentavious Street, and there's a whole group of guys here that have this collective energy that's really interesting. You need all of those guys to take steps forward with their play, and not all of them are going to be able to make the roster. And so you've got this depth and this fight jobs going on right now that's going to be really interesting to watch play out as they get a little bit more intense, obviously with the scrimmage on Tuesday, the preseason game on Saturday, the crossover practices and the preseason games the following 2 weeks. There's a lot more action ahead where this is really going to start to come to life, and you're going to get a better feel for just what this defensive line looks like on the interior. And so I think it's going to be fun to watch that come together and see who's ready to earn their keep and take that next jump.
You guys have mentioned Jordan Vanderburg. There's been a lot of talk about him the last few days, Dan. What are you seeing from Vandenberg? He's a guy that when they picked him, and I did some research on him, I really was intrigued by. He had his RAS score was like all-time great. And so you knew he was athletic, but what have you been seeing from him and that has been allowed him to push? And now he's getting, even today we saw he's getting reps still with the number one team.
Well, I'll give you two things that jump out every time you watch him. And the first is raw athleticism. You just mentioned what is in his body. You know, it's different. There's power. There's agility. There's some just really cool explosion that you see almost on an everyday basis when he's there. And then I would just say the competitive fearlessness that he's brought to camp. You know, this isn't a rookie that just seems like he's like not trying to upset anyone. You know, it's a guy that's going out here, and every time he gets an opportunity to have a competitive rep, he's trying to win it, and he's trying to win it in a way that's convincing. And so that's fun. I mean, you've heard me forever, Studs, talk about juice. Like, this is a juice guy, you know, and you load your team up with juice guys, you're going to see some fun things come to life, you know. And so it'll be interesting to watch where he goes, but I know from the front office on down to the coaching staff, they're very excited about his buy-in and what they have to work in. You marry those two things together and then you just go to work.
Speaking of juice, a lot of people were wondering juice. After an off season of trying to get
apple,
healthy.
Apple is my favorite.
how much juice are you seeing from Jalen Johnson right now after a season marred by injury and him playing at two or three steps slower than what we're used to seeing?
Yeah, it looks better, you know, and that's encouraging because obviously you need him to be a difference maker in a secondary that's depleted, in a secondary that's going to have to make up for some of the deficiencies that we anticipate with the pass rush. Jalen is supposed to be one of your best defenders. He's played through camp with flashes that tell you that physically he's there, you know, and all he needs to do, he's never going to lose confidence. And like, that's Jalen to a T. He's going to be the most confident defensive back on the field every time he steps out there. And so now you just have to continue to stack days together where the reps look good, where the physicality looks good, where everything leads you to believe that the health setbacks are in the rearview mirror. And so to this point, you know, that test has been passed. And so again, what are we at? August 8th, right about now, you got 3 more weeks now to really just dive into the grind and put those days together in a way that builds momentum toward the regular season.
Dan Weider of The Athletic, Bears reporter, senior writer at The Athletic, and co-host of Take the North podcast. Thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
You got it. Always enjoy talking.
We'll talk to you in the group chat there, Dan. We'll get the schedule figured out.
So, a lot to break down there. Plenty of injuries. Plenty of silver linings offensively. An offensive staff that thinks that they can score on anybody. And a defense that it's going to have to create a lot of pressure. Probably, once again, turnovers. And be much better against the run than they were last year. And when I say pressure, I mean relative to last year, where it was non-existent.
They need to, of all those things you just said, man, they have to be better against the run.
Yep.
You know, the turnovers, yep. I don't expect them to necessarily lead the league in turnovers again, but I expect them to get plenty of turnovers because that's Al Harris's defensive backs lead the league in turnovers like every year. So as long as he's here, they're going to get plenty of turnovers. They need to defend the run better. Just defending the run. Give us league average run defense.
Yeah.
Maybe even slightly below league average run defense. Don't be bottom third of the league run defense, and they'll be okay. Right? They don't need to have an all-world defense to win a bunch of games this year. We don't think so anyway. So, yeah, that's the main thing that I think we're all going to be focused on. I'm going to be focused on. Is the run defense. So yeah, that's what they got to get figured out. And look, if a guy like Jordan Vanderburg can step up and plug some holes, hell yeah, man. I'm a big fan of him. You dig more into his story, he's got a great story. The fact that he was even drafted is wild.
Yeah, a guy that went to junior college at 240 pounds and put on close to 60, 70 pounds over the course of his career, and he went to Penn State, didn't make a huge impact there, then went to Georgia Tech, didn't make a huge impact his first year, then finally in his final season, his seventh year in college, makes a big impact for the Yellow Jackets and was drafted in the sixth round because of his raw athletic tools by the Bears and Ryan Poles and Dennis Allen. Dennis Allen has had a good run of success finding these guys late in the draft or undrafted. Do you think about in 2014 where he was the head coach of the Raiders and they found Denico Autry as an undrafted free agent? David Onyemata with the Saints comes to mind as a fourth round pick. Shai Tuttle became a starting defensive tackle in the league. These aren't guys that you're going to see make Pro Bowls,
No. But
you don't need him to make a Pro Bowl. The question that I have is he going to find his way into the rotation as a rookie?
Well, and we didn't have time to ask Dan this. The one concern is he's clearly making enough plays that the defensive staff and Ben Johnson have elevated him up the depth chart, right?
Right.
But is this also a reflection of no one else is making enough plays? That's the counterweight. And I like to think it's not, because it sounds like he's just having a really good camp. But the only drawback would be, and I don't typically think like this, I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here, is it because no one else is making enough plays? And I hope that's not the case. I don't think it is. I haven't heard necessarily people up there saying, man, this defensive line sucks, but this guy's really standing out. So good for him. And by the way, Jordan Vandenberg owns a laundromat. Because that's like, they were like,
Starter.
Starter,
Pro Bowler, guaranteed.
So they asked him
in his first
press conference after he was drafted, they asked him, I don't know how this question came up, but it was basically like, what did you do with your NIL money? Basically, he's like, I opened a laundromat in my hometown as I wanted to help the community out. I wanted to invest the money in something, And it's like, who would have thought? What a nice kid.
What a nice kid.
Giving back to the community.
312.
Not what I would have done with that money. That much.
312-644-6767. We'll get back to some Bears talk at the top of the hour. But when we come back, Pete Crow Armstrong, one of the leaders in the clubhouse right now in the NL MVP race, he said something recently about how he thinks his way through games, or maybe doesn't think his way through games at times. You'll hear him in his own words next on The Score.
Lefty to lefty, Bush trying to come through. Pete's running. The pitch low, throw to third base. It's a wild throw. Pete's going to score. Cubs win the ball game. Cubs win. Pete Crow Armstrong stealing third. The ball bounced off the glove of Smith. It rolled out into left field. Pete Crow Armstrong scores the winning run. What a ball game.
That was Pat Hughes' call of the Cubs' Thursday victory over the Toronto Blue Jays 3-2 in 11 innings, in which Pete Crow Armstrong, right now the front runner in the NL for the Most Valuable Player Award, scored the winning run. Alex Kuhn alongside Adam Studzinski. We've got Grant Leader on the other side of the glass. We are live and we are local until 7 o'clock this evening. Taking your phone calls, 312-644-6767. Cubs fans, can the Cubs catch the Brewers in the NL Central? And if you say no, how far can this team go in the postseason? 312-644-6767. So Pete Crow Armstrong right now, one of the most interesting players in sports and in baseball. And I always wondered, somebody wired like that, who just wears his emotion on his sleeve, how can you succeed in the game of baseball? It's a very difficult sport with a lot of failure, and it's very difficult for people who are emotional like that, including, I say this from my own experience, as I tend to be like that when every at-bat, when I was younger playing that sport, it was a struggle. It was constantly in my own head, and I just have to... I can't imagine, but thinking about somebody in the major leagues who even has more of that FU to him.
Well, that's interesting because he's so low key off the field,
right?
Too,
but on the field, he's
He's a dynamo.
He is. He's a powder keg. So he was on the Old Man in the Three podcast with Cam Johnson, and he talked a little bit about what it's like, his headspace when playing the game.
Yeah, you got to be excited to go out there every inning. And it's important, too, to like actually take some pitches. Not take some pitches off, but like the time in between pitches. Like, if nobody's on, I'm letting my mind wander. Like, I'm looking up into the bleachers, seeing who's there. Like, you got to, like, check out sometimes so you can lock it back in.
Oh, man.
It's almost like ADD.
See, yes. And once again, as someone who has ADD, absolutely. ADD brain mixed with wanting to do well and wanting to focus at all moments can burn you out. And hearing him say that, it connected the dots on a couple of things. Remember earlier this season where we saw those lapses. We saw at times him just drop a fly ball where you don't expect him to. Lose a ball in the lights. Throw the ball into the third base dugout on a play that he has no business throwing the ball to third base, or throwing the ball 15 feet over the catcher's head.
He's trying to do too much.
Right. But since May 30th, right, I use that as the demarcation line because that was the night that he hit the ball. He hit the home run into the tarps off crew in St. Louis after they chanted overrated. Do you have the stats since May 30th?
I do. So this is, I didn't even realize how good this is. And this is why he's leading the MVP race right now. By the way, I just looked at I looked on FanDuel to see what the odds are. He's actually minus odds for on FanDuel.
So he's a favorite, right?
Yeah, he is. He's minus 122. Shohei Ohtani's plus 100.
Hello.
So that's he's put a little distance in there in the last week since he's overtaken that, at least the betting odds race. But anyway, these stats are actually mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. So since May 30th, the day he hit that home run, he has a slash line of 345, 452, 711, an OPS of 1163, which, if you're not overly familiar with OPS, anything over like 850 is good. If you're over 1,000, you're in the Hall of Fame. Walk-in Hall of Famer. So that's pretty good. He has 20 home runs, 5 triples, 15 doubles. None of that's really that shocking. His strikeout to walk ratio
is
excellent. Yep. 76 strikeouts to 42 walks, which for him, I should say, is excellent.
This is the thing. It's excellent for anybody. Right now, this is what blows my mind because...
Well, he's completely changed his hitting profile, which is insane.
We talk about ADD brain. And sometimes when playing that sport, it gets in the way because you constantly have anxiety of, am I focusing enough? And there's so much downtime in that sport. And for somebody,
it's more downtime than not.
Right. So it leads to him being overly aggressive. And he cares so much about how well he does from at bat to at bat. And so when I look at the statistics last year, according to StatCast, he had a 4.5% walk rate. That was lower 4% in all of Major League Baseball.
That's not something you'd normally see a complete flip on.
Correct. And
especially at this point in your career.
Even when he got hot in the first half, you're like, okay, his bat to ball isn't great, and he's really going to have to become more patient at the plate for this to be sustainable, right? So as it stands right now, Pete Crow Armstrong is in the upper 16% in all of baseball in walk rate, 12.3%. He has tripled his walk rate from last season. And to me, this shows coping mechanisms for him. He knows that he is always going to be high strung, and he is always going to be emotional. And this sport is always going to be... To bring out the best and the worst in him at times.
Right.
But these types of, I got to know when I can turn my brain off for a second, because for somebody like Pete in this sport, in baseball, your brain can be your own worst enemy.
It can. And yeah. It's excellent that he's clearly found a way to handle all of the everything that comes with the sport. and find time to relax and even not necessarily, not literally drop your heart rate, but metaphorically let your heart rate drop for a few beats, you know, the 20 seconds between pitches.
Yep.
Especially when you're in the field.
Right.
Right. Because at the plate, I imagine he's talking mainly out in the field because the plate, you're kind of constantly
Correct.
Thinking.
Correct.
So that's, I wonder, I would love to hear Ian Happ respond to that.
Right.
Because I just feel like Ian Happ looks like he's just always so focused.
Mm-hmm.
He's always got that, he's stoic. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. They're just not the same type of player. I would love to hear Ian Happ respond to that.
Has the 30,000 foot view of everything.
Right.
And it sometimes fans get a little upset with him because of it, because to a fault, he is always going to look through that lens of, okay, where are my numbers at? How's the macro of everything look? Pete, on the other hand, is not like that. He is not wired like that. He, every at bat at times throughout his career, is, it's almost felt like he's carrying the whole weight of his career on one or two at bats, which is not something that you can do and expect long-term success in baseball. So when I hear him say that, I mentioned how that's his coping, but it also reminds me of some of those lapses where you're early in the year, you're like, okay, Pete, is your brain turned on? And maybe it just wasn't. Like, and now he's found those moments during the course of the game where he can throttle things down a little bit and not let it affect his game, because at this point he's played so many major league games. I know he's young. I know he's only 24 years old, but at this point he's a seasoned major league player.
Oh, he is. He is. Yeah. He's no longer somebody that's a prize. This is, and this might, I highly doubt that this level of hitting, I don't know how sustainable it's going to be, but I mean, this is, well, yeah, getting like the Barry Bonds level.
Yeah, the Barry Bonds numbers that he's put up since May 30th.
Right. Yeah. So, but this is longer sustained than his extraordinary hot streak last season.
If he has a 50% percentile walk rate every year, he's going to be a perennial all-star.
Oh, of course he will. He's probably going to be a perennial all-star anyway.
Right. Because of what he does in the field.
Right. Right. And so, but if he keeps up, the number one thing I think you're going to be looking at going into the future is keeping up that walk to strikeout ratio, because that is, it's so extraordinary that he was able to completely flip that around.
Yep.
You just don't see it. And it's something, how many years did we sit here in this town watching Javi Baez be this dynamic, similarly dynamic player who everyone loves,
right?
But man, he just couldn't lay off a curveball.
Yeah.
And he never, still can't.
And Joe Maddon say, hey, if he could lay off that slider away,
right,
he'd be Manny Ramirez.
Yeah.
And how we said it with PCA too, like if he could increase that walk percentage up
just a little bit, yeah,
he's an all-star, and now he's in the top 60. He is in the 84th percentile of walk rate in Major League Baseball, and that is why he is the front runner for most valuable player.
And the more I look into it, because I was going back and forth on and trying to be as objective as possible, because you know we see PCA every single day here in the city. We hear about Shohei Ohtani, but we don't see him every day. Now we saw him for like a week straight when the Dodgers were here playing the Sox and then in the Cubs. But so you just kind of lean more towards PCA because we see him more, and because he plays for a Chicago team, so of course we want him to win it, right? The more I looked into it now, I got to start leaning more towards PCA. But the problem is, and Grody has brought this up multiple times, even though Shohei Ohtani isn't pitching right now, you can't take away the fact that he has pitched this year and in 14 starts had a 1.79 ERA. I know, and so I hope that PCA wins. That'd be awesome.
And his all-around game helps him, though, in this regard. Right,
it does well. And you know, look, the flip side of this,
he's,
if you're going to argue
a 10 WAR player,
if you're going to argue against that, you look at the WAR.
Yeah,
right. And PCA has a higher WAR than Shohei Ohtani right now. And also, it's because of what he does, I should say, in the field.
Yeah,
because he's probably going to win a platinum glove. If he doesn't this year,
what's more important, 80 innings from a pitcher or the best defensive outfielder in the game now?
The best defensive outfielder in the game, and at the 99th percentile, so almost the best hitting outfielder in the game too. It's going to be interesting to see. What we need to do... Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Steph. No, I think it's going to be a really close vote.
We are up against it for a break. Alex Kuhn alongside Adam Studzinski. You heard from Grant Leader there, who's on the other side of the glass. Back to some Bears talk on the other side of this break. A lot of people want to move Darnell Wright to left tackle. Studs asks, why? That's next on The Score.
On left tackle, right tackle, like the old school way of blindside. If you don't acquire or develop an elite left tackle, would there be a day where you may consider putting Darnell to the other side?
No, I don't think that's necessary. I think pass rushers are equally good on both sides these days. I don't subscribe to that viewpoint necessarily. I think he does a really good job on the right side. He's very comfortable over there. And we'll continue to find that left tackle that helps complement our offense and does great things. I go back to what do we look for first and foremost in our tackles. They need to be able to block a defensive end one-on-one on a consistent basis. That's the starting point. And then everything else is really gravy on top of that.
Bears head coach Ben Johnson talking about Darnell Wright, the new highest-paid right tackle in all of football. 4 years, $116 million extension was given to Darnell Wright earlier this week. I'm Alex Kuhn alongside Adam Studzinski, Grant Leader, our producer on the other side of the glass. We're going to be with you until 7 o'clock. We are Bears through the rest of the show, so if you want to get in on the conversation, phone line 312-644-6767. And Studs, you don't want to see Darnell Wright move over to left.
I've been on this crusade, it feels like, for a year. Ever since last year when the Bears were in the midst of their left tackle competition, the idea was floated out there by multiple people, whether it's on this station or other Bears reporters out there. Well, you know, why not move Darnell Wright to left tackle? And I just don't get it. He is an all-pro right... Last season, he hadn't been an all-pro right tackle yet. But as of right now, he's an all-pro right tackle.
He was last year.
Yes. This time last year, I'm saying, he hadn't been yet. But right now, he was second-team all-pro right tackle, right? By definition, he's now the best right tackle in the league because Penei Sewell's on the left side now. And I think that people see, oh, hey, the Lions did that with Penei Sewell. Why don't the Bears do that with Darnell Wright? The Bucs did this with Tristan Wirfs, right? He started his rookie year, he was a right tackle, and he moved to left. And
Correct.
He's one of the best left tackles, maybe the best left tackle
after
in the league.
After he got paid.
Yes. And so I think people see those situations, say, hey, why not do that with Darnell Wright? So I understand that, but I look at a guy that is currently the best right tackle in the league, and I say, keep him there. Because, and Ben Johnson talked about this, it used to be 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, you had your best offensive lineman as your left tackle, because usually that's where the best edge rusher was coming
Correct.
From. That's Lawrence Taylor is coming off the offense's left side. You need your best guy over there. And it's not the case anymore. These guys move all over the place. Right. And in fact, most of the time when I watch games anyway, I don't have the stat to prove this, but most of the time, the best edge rusher on the other team is coming off the offense's right side. Max Crosby is on the offense's right a lot. Yes. Micah Parsons moves all over the place. Montez Sweat is on the offense's right side a lot. So it's become more equal, is the point I'm trying to make here, between your left and your right tackle. And that's why Ben's talking about, hey, you need good players on both sides. They're going to keep searching for a really good left tackle, and hopefully they find one. And maybe it ends up being Braxton Jones. Maybe Ozzie Chiprillo comes back healthy, whatever. You know Darnell Wright's an all-pro right tackle. I say keep him there. And I don't even want to have the conversation about moving him, personally.
You don't want to weaken that spot to possibly weaken two spots in order to possibly improve the left side leave the right side in less of a dominant fashion.
Well, no, because you don't know what he looks like on the left side in the NFL. He played some left tackle, not some. He played a decent amount of left tackle in college.
A little bit.
Right.
Not a ton.
But the thing that got him drafted 10th overall was playing right tackle.
Correct.
And, sorry, one second, Alex. They have not seen him in the NFL play left tackle. at least not in a game. Maybe, I'm sure they've messed around with it a little bit in practice, maybe just to have him ready in a real emergency situation. Or, like, hell, sometimes they put him over there on screen plays. The game when he touched down against the Packers in the wild card round, Darnell Wright was lined up, like, tackle over on the left side.
Right.
And, but you haven't seen him over there. Now, the difference, Penei Sewell played some left tackle when he got into the league. No, just a little bit. Right when they needed him to.
And I believe he played it in college as well.
So, exactly. So you've seen him over there. Darnell Wright is a right tackle. And I could be wrong someday, but I think he's going to be a right tackle his whole career, and he's going to be a damn good one.
Bears had the highest EPA of running through any gap on the right side at 0.15 extra points added per play, expected points added per play. Off the right end, it was 0.34. If you're wondering what the scale is, a really good EPA is between 0.10 and 0.20. And the rest of the rest of the offensive line up the middle, 0.06 to the right guard, off right guard, 0.02, left guard, minus 0.12, left tackle, 0.04. The Bears ran the ball almost 70% of the time, either up the middle or to the right side. And when you have a right-handed quarterback and you're not worried about a dominant, like a predominantly left side of the offensive line pass rush, it sets up your play action, because most of the time when you're running play action, you're faking the ball to the right.
Yes.
That's the side that the quarterback opens up to. So when you're running the ball downhill 70% of the time to the right side, and then you're going play action, it just makes that play action game that much more lethal, which we saw last season.
And I expect it to continue to be that way, because Darnell Wright is on the right side of the line.
Go ahead.
Well, and I just think it would be, I don't think that it's quite the same conversation as what happened with Penei Sewell or what happened with Tristan Wirfs.
Not yet.
Yeah.
If you're going to do this, you need an entire offseason. Maybe you draft somebody who you think is a dominant right tackle and can only play right tackle, and then you move Darnell Wright over. There needs to be more lead time. You need an entire offseason, and somebody who you feel like is going to be really good on that right side. But until then, you get by with what you got. You have a dominant right tackle, a dominant left guard, a dominant right guard, and some stability. We'll see about center. I have more on the center position a little bit later in the show. But when we come back, the Bears are injured.
Sexy center talk.
5 weeks until opening day, just a few days before the first preseason game. How worried are you? 312-644-6767. More Bears talk next on The Score.